Hello, I'm Oliver Wong of Heat Rocks, and we have another mailbag minisode for you all. This one comes from Scott Armstrong. The question, I should say, comes from Scott Armstrong. And his question was, quote, music you discovered and now love from a hip-hop sample, unquote. I guess I didn't technically phrase that as a question, but you get the idea. So music that you discovered and now love from a hip-hop sample. Well, Scott, how much time you got? Because I could do multiple weeks and weeks of episodes about this very question. But in all seriousness, I thought to tackle it, besides just lending my own opinion on this, I wanted to bring in one of the experts on sample-based hip-hop production, and that is Dr. Joseph Schloss, author of two of the greatest books ever written about hip-hop culture, 2004's Making Beats, The Art of Sample-Based Hip-Hop, and 2009's Foundation, B-Boys, B-Girls, and Hip-Hop Culture in New York. Seriously, Joe has done more to advance hip-hop studies than practically any scholar I can think of. He's also a very good friend and role model. Joe is joining us from, I believe, what, Crown Heights in Brooklyn?
That's right.
Well, Joe, welcome to Heat Rocks.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, and thanks for that extremely flattering introduction. I appreciate it.
I meant every single word there, and I've, you know, I have tried to be a proselytizer for your scholarship over the years, especially because as you and I mean, we first met like, God, probably over 20 years ago, and really bonded on sort of the state of hip hop scholarship at the time, or perhaps our complaints about hip hop scholarship at the time. And I think you have done a lot to kind of walk the walk in terms of just advancing the quality of the work that's out there. So I mean that very, very sincerely. Before we actually get to Scott's question, I wanted to actually revisit your book, Making Beats, which was originally based on, if I remember correctly, your graduate school dissertation. And as an ethnomusicologist, what prompted your interest in studying hip-hop production as a topic?
Well, actually, you were part of that decision. I don't know if you remember, but I was originally, I was interested in hip-hop music already, and I was going to study basically flow from a musicological standpoint. But I wasn't that into it as an idea. And at some point I was talking to you and we had a conversation I was hanging around with a lot of hip hop producers at that time because I was writing for a magazine in Seattle called The Flavor, which was an underground hip hop magazine.
Shout out.
Yeah, that's what gave me my start writing. And so I was hanging around with a lot of producers and just like kind of eavesdropping on their conversations. And I was awestruck. You know, I remember I was at a barbecue once and they were arguing about, I was sitting at a picnic table with a bunch of local producers in Seattle and they were arguing about the origins of a specific snare hit in some song. And I was like, not only can these people recognize one snare drum, but they care enough about it to actually take the time to argue about it. And I was like, this is completely fascinating. And if I remember correctly, we were talking about that and you were like, you should write your dissertation about that. And I was like, just for some, you know, sometimes you're in that situation where you know something in the back of your mind, but it doesn't really click until somebody confirms it for you.
Sure.
And I think that's my recollection, at least, is you said, you were like, you should write your dissertation about that. And I was like, yeah, I should, and I did. So thank you for that. And it kept my interest for still to this day. So
I'm wondering, at the time, what was one of the biggest surprises or takeaways that you landed on in the course of doing your research?
I think for me, at that time, the idea that there were whole personality types involved in hip-hop that were not part of the stereotypical view of what hip-hop was about. And specifically, the producers I met pretty much 100% were basically nerds. They're basically music nerds. And obviously, I related to that very strongly as a nerd myself. But it never occurred to me that that type of person was that central to hip-hop until I started moving in those circles. And so that, in certain ways, that really changed the way I thought about hip-hop, because it made me realize that there were roles involved in it that were not necessarily apparent to the public and were not apparent to me up until that point.
Yeah.
And that's continued to be the case ever since then. There are a lot of different types of people involved in hip-hop and always have been.
Yeah. Now, it's been probably, I'm sure, over 20 years since you began the research that went into the book. And so I'm wondering, from a 2020 perspective, where do you see the state of sample-based hip-hop now? You know, I think for people, like my daughter, for example, listens to a lot of contemporary hip-hop music, but so much of that is really influenced by trap and trap-style production, which doesn't use that many obvious samples. I mean, I'm sure on some level they might be sampling different drums and to go into the drum programming, but we're not talking, you know, four-bar loops and a lot of trap.
Yeah, it's totally different now on many levels, in terms of how it's done, in terms of how people learn about it, in terms of what you're expected to know to be a producer, in terms of what you're expected to be able to do to be a producer. In those days, pretty much all producers were DJs, which is not true at all now. So it's a totally different body of knowledge. I mean, I started doing the research for this kind of informally in the late 80s, really, because I've always been interested in this subject, but formally in 1998, so that 22 years ago.
Yeah.
And I look at the book now as like a document of a historical era.
Right.
A lot of the things that I talked about are just not the case anymore, which is fine. I think the differences are mainly sort of in the relationship. Well, two main differences. One is that hip hop itself was so influential that ways of making music that used to be only secret hip hop things are now part of all popular music. So it's hard to draw a strict line between hip hop and other musical forms anymore on that level. And then the other thing is, as you well know, a lot of the information in terms of content, you know, like what the samples were, but also how to flip them and stuff like that, was like secret information that was handed down to a select group of people. And that's definitely not true anymore.
Right.
You know, I was thinking about in your introduction, it used to be that you would hear, even if you knew what a sample was, you wouldn't be able to just hear it. You had to find the record. So you could know that something was sampled from a particular group for years before you actually found the record, before you actually heard the original song. So that was part of it too. I think that that kind of scavenger hunt aspect had more emotional power to it, because there wasn't any other way to have that experience other than by digging. So that's definitely changed. And that then, I think, has rippled out through the whole thing. Like the idea of being like, I mean, in the old days, it used to be like, look at this sample. Like that's what a lot of hip hop music was.
Yeah.
And now that doesn't mean anything anymore. So you wouldn't do that even if you could necessarily.
Mm. So in a sense, what you're saying that today's producers, if they use samples, are doing it because it serves a particular function musically, in terms of this is how I want things to sound, and this sample delivers on that on some level, as opposed to, I just spent 3 weeks combing through basements in the middle of nowhere and check out the stuff that I found as a result of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think both of those things were always part of it, but I think the proportions are a little bit different now. Like, the idea of flipping a sample that somebody else used as a response to what they were doing, because it you know, that doesn't necessarily seem like it would have as much power now, just because of the context. Or just like one of the things that people used to do is there would be a record that somebody would sample, and then you would sample a different part of that same record. And for people in the community, that would be really eye-opening, because they would know, you know, that you knew where the sample came from.
Yeah.
But that kind of thing, I don't think is really that significant anymore, because anybody can find that information. You know,
I'm having a hard time properly coming up with exactly what question I want to ask here, but I guess because you and I both got our start, our entry into hip hop during this golden age of sample-based production, and we, as we've been discussing, we're now, you know, 20 years past that. Techniques have changed. The culture around sampling, I think, has changed for better or for worse. And I certainly don't want to get stuck in this amber trap of always looking back and wishing how things used to be. So I guess the better way to put this is, what do you see as being the future of sampling within production? I don't think as a production technique, it's going to disappear by the wayside, because it still has utility. But if part of that mystery and magic is gone, what's replaced it that's still compelling when it comes to using samples, I guess?
The thing about sampling is that it already won. Like, I think for me, initially, part of what intrigued me about sampling was that it, as a methodology, it was kind of an underdog. People didn't respect it. And, you know, I think correctly that it should get a lot more respect as a musical strategy than it did. And eventually, I think that battle has been won. So the fact, I can't be mad about the fact that people understand what's going on now. You know, I might have a little nostalgia for the old days when we were fighting these institutional forces to get recognition, but I can't be mad that we won. And so that's basically how I look at it. And I think that's just part of getting older too, is the things that used to be underground become more and more accepted. People are using punk rock songs and Viagra commercials, you know, and that's just the way of the world.
Well, let's get back to Scott's question. And I don't know about you, but when I was in my 20s, and this, I spent most of my 20s in the 1990s, I absolutely learned so much about soul music, funk music, and especially jazz music through samples, especially in that era. I don't think my musical education could have been or would have gone anywhere near the same way without samples helping to lead the way to a certain extent. How about for you?
Oh yeah, definitely. And part of, it's funny that you specified jazz music, because for me, I was already interested in jazz music, but the kind of jazz music that was being sampled in hip hop was totally different from what I was taught about in school. Right. And it's still not really that well respected by like jazz scholars and stuff like that. You know, basically 70s kind of electric jazz.
Fusion stuff, yeah.
Fusion, the beginnings of what might later become smooth jazz, stuff like that. So the idea that there was something kind of funky and organic and valuable in that subgenre of jazz was very, very eye-opening to me. And I actually had, now that you mention it, I came to it in a weirdly backwards way, because there was a period when I was, people were using more jazz samples and I was trying to listen to more and more. I realized I was looking for hip hop that sounded like jazz. And at a certain point, I realized, partially through hanging out with hip hop producers, that what I should be doing is looking for jazz that sounded like hip hop, because that's what producers were doing. And that was actually what I wanted to hear. And so that in a more general way was a big thing that hip hop gave to me, is an appreciation of that whole style of jazz, which I still listen to this day, for sure.
So yeah, let's get into it. Let's come back to Scott's question, which is what's an example of a song that you discovered through sampling that you now love? And each of us came up with three examples, and Joe, as our guest, why don't you kick things off for us?
All right, so the first one that I was thinking of was Sneakin' in the Back by Tom Scott. It's a great sample because it starts out with a break, and it's a very kind of slow, funky break. It's not a hard, fast break, so that was kind of different. And it opened up a lot of possibilities for what you were going to use it for, because you could use it to make this kind of mellow, more kind of smooth, funky song. And then after the opening break, there's also a great electric piano line that you could also use. That's the first sample that I can remember consciously searching for. It was sampled in a lot of things, but the first thing I heard it sampled in was Queen Mother Rage in her song Mental Erection from that record Vainglorious Law, which I think to me is one of the most, if not the single most underrated hip hop album of all time.
You know Professor X, they're gonna label us freaks, speaking of sex when the text is to teach. The penetrate and the move is the reach. Wisdom is an orgasm. It gets deep.
She was affiliated with X-Clan, and so yeah, it was kind of an X-Clan type thing. Her vocal tone is incredible. Her flow is incredible. Her writing is incredible. It was very political. It used all those classic samples. And that album came out, I think, 91. And it just hit me really hard. So that song, I was like, I want to find out what that sample was. That But in those days, if it wasn't on the liner notes, there it was very difficult to figure that out,
right,
other than by digging or by talking to people who already knew. So I remember I was like literally going up to DJs that I knew and singing the sample to them, being like, do you know what this is? Once I went out and got the song, and in fact, I still have the record and I pulled it in thinking about this, and the price tag on it was $1.99. So that's another part of the attraction in those days, is that you could go on this incredible adventure and then find your treasure at the end of it for $2. That's very fulfilling, especially if you're a broke graduate student. I still love the whole song to this day, and Tom Scott is still active to this day, and he's also known for some other very important hip hop samples. And so that opened up his whole, you know, his whole body of work.
Well, I think it's only apropos that you began with the jazz sample, because as we were talking a little bit earlier, I feel like if nothing else, I learned a lot about jazz. And to your previous point, I learned a lot about jazz that jazz purists tend to dismiss, which is the whole kind of late 60s, early 70s, soul jazz, fusion jazz era. But that was huge for me as someone learning about jazz through hip hop and through the samples that people were picking up. And so the very first example, when I saw this question that Scott had posed on our Facebook page, the first example that popped in my head is the 4-bar sample that powers Nas's One Love from Illmatic. What up, kid? I know shit is rough doing your bit. When the cops came, you should have slid to my crib. Fuck it, black, no time for looking back is done. Plus, congratulations, you know you got a son. Illmatic, of course, as an album, I think, launched all manners of different crate diggers to go out there and track down all of the samples on it, myself included. And while this is, I think, an album that is filled with just awesome, at this point now, iconic samples, I would argue that the loop behind One Love is first amongst equals. It's a track, of course, that was produced by Tribe Called Quest Q-Tip, and not surprisingly, he dug into his own very deep jazz crates to pull out a loop of what I have to imagine would have been a rather obscure source circa 1994, which is part two of the Smilin' Billy Suite by the Heath Brothers on their 1976 Strata East LP, Marchin' On. This song has a bit of a history in terms of it began life originally as a song called Smilin' Billy, and this was featured on Jimmy Heath's 1973 album Love and Understanding. Then when the group joined up with Stanley Cowell and Charles Tolliver's Strata East label, they turned that one song into a 4-part, I think it's like an 18-minute suite. And so the thing is here is that Q-Tip uses the beginning of part two of the suite, which is understandable. This is the part two opens up with this beautiful kalimba thumb piano. It has this really unique, distinctive sound to it. And it certainly is, I think, a highlight of the entire suite. But the entire suite is incredible. I mean, that opening to part two is not the only good part on it. It's just one of many amazing parts on it. And so to only know the loop, I think, if you miss experiencing the entire song, the entire suite, is really a missed opportunity. And so, for example, this is Percy Heath's bass from part one of the Smilin' Billy suite. I suppose it's possible I might have eventually stumbled across the Heath Brothers and the Marching On album at some point by the latter half of the 1990s, because there was a lot of interest in Strata East through compilations and anthologies that began to emerge around then. But I absolutely would never have known anything about the group and about this song and about this album if not for One Love and what Q-Tip and Nas did with the sample. And so that's why I was saying earlier, this was the very first thought that came into my head when I looked at Scott's question, because the Smilin' Billy Sweet Part 2 is just something I would never have known about, at least not at that point, had it not been sampled. And so it is really to this day still one of my all-time favorite jazz songs and jazz albums. Joe, what's your next example?
All right, my second choice is Heather by Billy Cobham. It's the kind of fundamental sample from 93 Till Infinity by Souls of Mischief.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's the perfect sample to play for people, because when they hear it, they instantly recognize what it is and what was done to it to make it into the hip-hop song, which is basically they sped it up to double speed and filtered the bass line. What I love about that is it to me, it kind of exemplifies the sampling mindset, which is you're listening to something and you hear like, if I loop this and do a couple things to it, it will be a hip hop song. It's not a hip hop song now. And I think a lot of people that would listen to it who didn't have a hip hop mentality would be like, there's no way you could turn something like this into a hip hop song. It doesn't sound like a hip hop song. Unless you're coming from the point of view of a hip-hop producer, and then you're like, oh, I know what I can do with this. So I think it's a really fun, straightforward example. And it's 93 Till Infinity is a great song. Heather itself is a great song. And they're totally different in their feel, in their mood, in their style. And yet there's that deep connection through sampling. So I just, to me, it's just personally just one of the kind of quintessential examples of how sampling works, what it does, and how it can create meaning in a song.
Even though 93 Till Infinity owes a lot of what makes it memorable to that sample, it's not as if it was just a one-to-one sampled in real time, in real tempo, and that the producers, I don't know if that was Domino or A Plus who produced 93 Till Infinity, I forget now, but one of the folks in the Hyro camp, it's not as if they just took it wholesale and did very little to it, right? They changed it, they altered it. And yet both songs can kind of exist in relationship to each other, where 93 Till Infinity is more than just its sample, but what makes it memorable is that Heather sample. And then you can go back to Heather and it stands by itself, to your point, right? It stands on its own as a song unto itself without needing the fact that it got sampled to make it good. But it's also why we know about it, for at least those of us who are not big Billy Cobham fans prior to its use.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, is that it seems like something simple to speed something up to double speed, but you wouldn't necessarily think of doing that. And it that's what was called for. You know, it really changed it. It reminds me sometimes, if you've ever watched like really high level judo practitioners.
No, that's not something I've spent a lot of time doing.
It's kind of a weird analogy. I don't know why I would have assumed that you would, but if you watch a really high level judo match, like probably 80% of it is the two fighters standing apparently almost completely still. And one of them will shift slightly and the other one will shift slightly to indicate that they're prepared to defend against it. And it looks like they're not doing anything. And I think I just say that as an analogy because like with a lot of real high level skills, from the outside, it looks like they're doing something very minor. Like, oh, I just flipped this slightly. I just turned it a little bit in this direction. But when you really have that expertise, it's not about the thing you're doing. It's about knowing which option to take. And in this case, it was speeding it up, which on the surface seems simple, but that's actually one of thousands of options that they could have taken. And they chose the right one to make it do what they wanted it to do.
Yeah. No, great point. For my next example, I'm going to go with if Tom Scott was your gateway into sample hunting, I think my gateway was the Emotions 1972 song Blind Alley. I'm sure for most people, they were probably introduced to this sample via Marley Marl and Big Daddy Kane's Ain't No Half Steppin' from 1988.
Oh yeah, I'm with this. I'm just gonna sit here laid back to this nice mellow beat, you know?
In 88, I had no idea about the Juice Crew, had never heard of them, had never heard of Kane, Marley Marl, certainly never heard of Ain't No Half-Stepping at the time. And so I didn't get introduced to the Blind Alley sample until 1992 when AMG, who was an artist out of Los Angeles, used it for his hit, Jiggable Pie. And even then, I didn't have an awareness that, okay, the reason why I like this Jiggable Pie song is because of its sample, and I just didn't really think of what is the sample behind it. I was a real latecomer, so even though I'd been listening to hip-hop for several years, and I understood the basics of they are sampling things, it wasn't until I made the connection between Blind Alley and Jiggable Pie that I'm like, oh, that's the sample that created this song. Again, I was a little bit of a slow learner back then. And it wasn't until I heard Blind Alley being played on the radio. And I think this was either on the Wake Up Show on KML, which I've talked about before, or it might have come through my late friend Matthew Africa's radio show on KLX, which is where I also was DJing. And in either case, I distinctly remember hearing this in my dorm room circa, like, I don't know, 1992 or 93. And it just finally clicked on me like, oh, this is how sampling works. Here's the original, which I recognize the parts used in the end product. And now I could actually go and maybe listen to the original song. And wow, this song is magical. And so over the years, I have spent a lot of time actually writing about Blind Alley. I certainly would put it very near the top of my list of my all-time favorite Stax Volt records, which is saying a lot because that entire catalog is immense and is remarkable. Blind Alley is just, it's so distinctive, it's so unique. I know I was just saying the same thing a minute earlier regarding the Heath Brothers with the Smilin' Billy Suite. But just the way that Blind Alley opens, I just can't think of another song that really sounds like it. And it didn't dawn on me until I was prepping for our chat today. I still am not 100% sure as to what that bell-like instrument is being used on the song. I'm assuming it's like on a Rhodes electric piano, but is it a vibraphone? Like, I don't have great ears for this sort of thing. Do you know what instrument is being used there?
Yeah, I can't tell what that is either. It doesn't really sound like a Fender Rhodes, although maybe they're playing very high without the tremolo on. Yeah, you got me on that one.
I did try to Google this. I did not try that hard to Google it because I kind of gave up after not finding any results that I wanted after the first page. But if someone out there knows, and someone out there must know the answer to this question, let us know, because I'm dying to know what is the instrument that's being used to create that beautiful, sublime little bell sound on Blind Alley. All right, Joe, How about your next example?
Bra by Samande, which might be pronounced bruh. I've never been completely sure about that.
Like bruh?
Yeah, well, I think that's what it means.
Right, they're not talking about like feminine support products.
That was always my assumption, but I don't know. I guess that's part of the mystery. This was sampled by De La Soul on Change and Speak.
Once again, it's time to buy more soul. The flavor you will savor in your soul. Wax is distributed in thin soul. Dishwasher sends it in your next kin soul.
De La was the first group that really opened me up to like what sampling could do. I love Public Enemy. I love some of those groups that were a little earlier than that. But De La was the one where I was like really thinking in terms of like, oh, they're using these samples and choosing them in a creative way and choosing weird stuff. But the thing is, that particular sample never really stood out to me that much. But I knew the name of the group because that was just, you know, knowledge that was out there in the community. But I had never actually heard Samande. I'm still not sure if that's the right way to pronounce the name of that group. But they're now one of my favorite groups. I mean, eventually, and so in those days, unless you had the record, especially with a group like Samande that was not that popular when they were really out, you weren't going to be able to hear that music unless you had the record or unless a DJ was playing it at some spot that you were at. So it was probably 10 years before I, maybe not 10 years, but at least 5 years before I actually got one of their records and listened to it. And they're one of my favorite groups now. I can listen to those first three records front to back and never have a dull moment. So it's not this for me in that case. The reason I chose that was it wasn't the sample itself, but it was the idea of the sample that made me want to look at this music that I never would have heard otherwise, and that ended up being very very valuable to me.
What I love about your pick here, Joe, is how I think Samande are a fantastic example of how groups and artists get rediscovered by later generations because of sampling. And of course, they're hardly the only one, or perhaps not even the most prominent one. But this is a group that in the 70s, when they put out their original albums, and this is well known about them, they were never really as successful as they, well, certainly as they hoped to be. They oftentimes felt like they were overlooked in their native UK. They never, I think, experienced the same level of recognition or success, commercial success, that a vaguely similar group like, let's say, LA's Mandrill were able to enjoy. So it really took that extra generation through sampling for people to come back to Samande and recognize how ahead of their time that group really was infusing all of these different musical influences into those really brilliant albums of theirs. And if not for sampling, it'd be very interesting to know, and this is kind of an impossible scenario to imagine in a lot of ways, but how would we remember Samande now if not for having these opportunities to rediscover them through sampling?
First of all, I always associate Samande with Mandrill for no reason. So it's funny that you mentioned that. I mean, I guess they have a similar sound. But because the thing with Samande is when I listen to them, I'm not listening for samples, and it's not really part of my thought process in appreciating that music. Like, oh, this person sampled it and that person sampled it. I just love the music for its own sake. But the reality is I never would have heard them if it weren't for hip hop. So that's a phenomenon that I think is really interesting that people don't necessarily think about that much when they think about sampling, which is even if you're looking at it from a purely financial standpoint, there are a lot of musicians that got either second careers or in some cases first careers from having their obscure records rediscovered. And that's a kind of underground value I think that sampling has that not everybody understands.
Yeah. For my last example, I went with actually a very recent example to answer Scott's question. And this is something that I just was very recently discussing on the Struggle Plate podcast, which just aired the other week. So make sure to check that out. But it totally fits into today's discussion here. And so at the beginning of the year, at the beginning of 2020, I was re-listening to Lil Wayne's Carter 5 album, which I think came out in late 2019. And there's a song on there called Demon.
Tweaking my energy, eating, die, sympathy, screaming, cry, infamy, come alive mentally, and love die physically, my love cry miserably, hugs getting looser, her tongue tied, kissing me, she fucked, died, nigga, see, now they both digging me, but demons got
digging. In listening to it the second time, I was like, wow, this is a pretty cool sample, whatever Demon is using, I wonder what it is, and so I think I went to whosample.com and discovered that it was a gospel song from the early 70s called Lord, Hold Me in Your Arms by a group called The Crowns of Glory. And the LP cover looked familiar, and I realized, oh, wait, I have this LP. In fact, I've had the album for years, but I picked it up because the album has a cover of Bill Withers' Ain't No Sunshine. That's the reason I got it. And I guess I'd never bothered to listen to any of the other tracks on the LP, and so I had totally slept on Lord, Take Me Into Your Arms. And then once I started to actually listen to the song, I couldn't stop. I just found it to be so incredibly sublime. In all seriousness, I think there was a day where I just put the song onto repeat for about an hour or two and just let it play over and over and over again. I just found it to be so enthralling, especially the way in which it ramps up at the end.
Jesus, hold me, hold me.
Had it not been for Lil Wayne and Demon, I don't know if I would have ever stumbled back across a song that was already in my collection that I had clearly never bothered to check out on the front end. And I don't know if there would have been a reason for me to have gone back to that same LP and start needle dropping across and being like, oh, this song, you know, A2 is fire. I guess I totally missed out on that. I really have Lil Wayne to thank for that.
That's like, to me, that's such a classic experience and such a great experience when you have it of, like, looking for a sample and then realizing that you already have it. So right. I once had a dream where I was searching everywhere for Keep Your Head to the Sky, the Earth, Wind & Fire album. And it's not even an obscure album, but in the dream, it was really hard to find. And I was going to all these record stores. And then eventually I got it. And right when I was about to buy it, I woke up. And I was like super frustrated. And then I remembered that I actually had the record in real life. And I just went over and put it on the record player. And it was so great because I still in my mind had that experience of having that search, even though it was just a dream. So that's one experience for me. But there are definitely a lot of situations where, I've been trying to figure out what something was and then realizing it was something I already had. And that's like, it's like a free gift from the universe, really.
I like the fact that you're also having record / sampling anxiety dreams too. I feel validated somehow that, you know, the stuff creeps into our subconscious on some level because we care so much. Well, Joe, thank you so much for taking some time out to chat with me about this. What are you working on these days?
Well, a lot of my focus right now is on hip hop dance. From doing this work on sampling, actually, I became interested in all these breakbeats and everything, and then I became very frustrated that I didn't know how to dance to them, so I started studying hip-hop dance, and that became my second book, Foundation. So I have a couple things coming out about hip-hop dance, not books or anything, but there's a great Oxford Handbook of Hip-Hop Dance will be coming out next year, edited by Imani Kai Johnson and Mary Fogarty Worrell, who are both great hip-hop scholars. And I have a long afterword to that where I'm kind of talking about basically, it's a little kind of manifesto about hip hop studies itself. I took a kind of advantage of this opportunity to talk about kind of the state of hip hop studies and what I think is missing from it, to be honest. I think dance in particular, but also a lot of other things, are marginalized a lot in hip hop scholarship. People are interested in certain things, and rightly so. There's nothing wrong with that. But you and I have had this conversation for a long time, is that there are certain subjects in hip hop that people are naturally drawn to. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's great. But it's important to remember what else there is out there to be studied. And so I think dance opens up a lot of possibilities about the body, about the nature of the way different communities use space in hip hop, social space and physical space. So that's something I've been interested in for a long time. And so in this long afterword, I kind of try to connect some dots about the way hip hop scholarship developed over the course of my time in it, why it developed the way it did, and what are some other branches that might be worth exploring in the future. So that's the main thing I've been working on.
That sounds fantastic. I can't wait to see that and read it. And before we wrap, Joe and I were talking before we started taping about last week's minisode with Lauren Kajikawa. And Lauren actually name-checked Joe a couple times, giving him credit for a quote about how the break is like the groove taking its clothes off. And Joe's here just to set the record straight about that.
Oh, yeah, I very much appreciated the shout, but I wasn't the person that wrote that quote, that great quote that he had. I don't know where it comes from, but I want to make sure whoever did say it gets the proper credit for that.
Well, if anyone out there knows where that quote comes from, let us know so we can set the record straight. And Joe, where can folks find you online if they want to know more about you and your work?
I'm at josephschloss.com, which is kind of, it might be hard to find without spelling it out, but if you just type in Joe Schloss, S-C-H-L-O-S-S, into Google, it's the first thing that comes up. So, and you can see a picture of me trying to look serious and intellectual, which is always fun.
Well, Joe, thanks again for joining us on this. It's such a fun episode to tape with you.
Thank you so much, man. It was a blast.
Wanted to thank Joe once again for joining us on this mini-sode, which was edited and produced by myself, Oliver Wong. This week is the week of Thanksgiving here in the U.S., and we will not have a new episode coming out this week, but in recognition of the 20th anniversary of several key albums, all produced by the Soulquarian Collective, which we have spoken about quite a lot on the show, we are putting together, and by we I mean our wonderful producer and editor, Christian Duenas, is stitching together a medley show of three different episodes in which we discuss the Soulquarians and their influence on contemporary hip-hop and R&B music. So check out for that when it drops, as all of our episodes do every week on Thursday. And with that, I bid you adieu, and we will see you next time.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist-owned. Audience-supported.